It is the Spirit that giveth life. The flesh is of no avail. The words spoken are spirit and life. Jan and I stood alongside our burial plots last Wednesday afternoon. I trust it will be many decades before we need to use them. Our post-retirement home is nestled in a long-forgotten old village cemetery in Eaton, New York. Eaton is the northern tip of Appalachia, economically, culturally, geographically, and historically. Its rural poverty has come rather lately to its 250-year history, but is as harsh and weather-beaten as any such rural immiseration across the country. Its country culture receives some odd jostling from Colgate University and Hamilton College, both a very few miles away. Its spot on the edge of the great cliff of the Allegheny Plateau places it at 1,200 feet above sea level, with lakes and Great Lakes 1,200 feet below within a 30-minute drive. Its history includes nearby Peterborough, a town built in the 1850s by Gerrit Smith for freed slaves, some of whose descendants live there still, and the Oneida community nearly next door, whose 300 perfectionists lived ostensibly without sin and within complex marriage for 30 years, 1845-1875. And down below at sea level, the shores of Gitche Gumee, the shining Big Sea water, near the wigwam of Nokomis, daughter of the moon, the homeland of Hiawatha, 1,200 feet down north. Our burial neighbors will include some born before the Revolution, some several who died in or served in the Civil War, many veterans of the conflicts of the 20th century, and one fellow who was interred in 1962, but in whose youth fought with Teddy Roosevelt in the Spanish-American War. One wonders about the ongoing work of mowing and trimming, and more so about the volunteer leadership needed to keep managed a venerable small graveyard. We were told that there had been no burials this calendar year to date. There they bury until November 1st and then after May 1st or as soon as the ground thaws in the spring. Jan said that she liked the spot. I volunteered that this was good since we would be there for a while. Actually, though, we should call on the economists here. When you amortize $400 per plot over the course of eternity, the cost is really very little. 400 divided by infinity, that's very reasonable. The rent may be too high across the country generally, but not in the Eaton Village Cemetery. Of course, I had sometimes mused about having a bit more upscale social location going forward, maybe something on the East Coast, Chatham or Castine or the Cape or Northampton, something with an ocean view and East Coast standards of comportment and attire and presentation. Jan reminded me that I am a Methodist preacher, a country preacher at that, and can ill afford such ostentation, neither fiscally nor spiritually. Besides, she rightly counseled, see all the beauty here. Yes, see it and hear it. Thank you, choir. Beauty is heard as well as seen. We jog past this place, so I know what the music of that meadow brings day by day. The rooster, or more than one, as dawn comes. The cattle feed away, lowing as cattle do. The wind in the evergreens and the two mighty oak trees, an occasional auto or truck or even more occasional airplane, visitors with crosses, flags, flowers, and tears. And then the sound of nothing. Silence. Hush. Hush. Somebody's calling my name. Hush, hush. Somebody's calling my name. In the deep winter, the deep silence must be thunderous. I think of the 4 months of real winter and the covering, the bedcloth of 4 feet of snow. and it is well with my soul. Let me reveal that I begin this way for a discreet homiletical purpose. I preach as a dying man to dying men, as Luther counseled. More so, our series of summer sermons this year has addressed hope in the face of death. Apocalyptic language and imagery in the New Testament is a language of hope in the face of death. The cosmic resurrection of Christ and the life he offers is a word of hope spoken into the teeth of cosmic, universal, personal, and individual death. All of our sermons this summer have been very human attempts to announce this unseen hope, embedded, deeply embedded, in the New Testament apocalyptic language and imagery. You know, sometimes at our worst, we move through life with the supposition that death comes to others, other people, other peoples, not something that befalls us, but others. This very human daily supposition is not limited to young adults, to this new wave of temporarily immortal 18-year-olds soon to wash up upon the BU beach. Nor is it limited to distracted, over-technologized, middle-aged parents trying to keep a household afloat amid the Great Recession of our era. Nor is it limited to the mature or the very mature, we who should probably know better with our flecks of gray hair. Time flies? Ah, no. Time stays. We go. A pastoral digression, I assign you an exercise for this week or some week. It is patented informally by me, but I give it to you, like the gospel itself, free of charge. It is the Robert Allen Hill OOPS formula for preparation for post-retirement. O, write your obituary, at least a first draft, which others can redact as needed. O, compose your funeral order of worship with hymns and texts and participants and memorials. P, select a photograph you do not mind being used in days of grieving in the newspaper or in the funeral home. S, locate your last location, your place and manner of burial or cremation, and place these materials in the same box or safe deposit box in which you already have placed your DNR, your living will, your will. You may choose to remember Marsh Chapel in your will, by the way, if you like, and any other significant materials. How your family will thank you. But as you are mortally aware, all of this preparation, good as it is not good enough. Not enough. For all this preparation lacks the main thing needed in the face of death, in the face of the power of death William Stringfellow so ardently and artfully described. At the end, at the grave as well. What matters at last at death is hope. Hope. The best thing about apocalypse then is hope. If someone asks you in the grocery store what you heard this summer at Marsh or from Marsh, you could say, well, I mean, I think they preached on the theme of apocalypse then, and I heard a word of hope. Which brings us to the conclusion, the end, if you will, of this summer's Marsh Chapel National Preacher Series on the theme, Apocalypse Then. I am personally and deeply grateful to my colleagues here at the Boston University School of Theology for their leadership, voice, and presence in this pulpit this summer. They gave us 2 summer Sundays. They gave hours of preparation. They gave the best of their hearts and minds, and they gave a willingness to treat the hardest material with the finest of skill. Their very physical presence brought us hope. It happens that we together, the preachers, all share an interest in New Testament apocalyptic, and with you, I thank Dr. Jennifer Knust, Dr. James Walters, Brother Larry Whitney, and Dr. David Jacobson for their preaching with me this summer. So what have we learned? Apocalyptic theology in the New Testament is a language of hope lifted in the face of death. At least This is how I would conclude and summarize our announcement of the gospel this summer. Apocalyptic followed the prophetic hope for justice on earth and preceded the late Platonic hope for life in heaven, building on the former and preparing the way for the latter. And we need them all three and many more. The prophets hoped for a righteous earth, the Gnostics hoped for a glorious heaven. The apocalyptic hope in the face of death is hope on earth as it is in heaven. A hope for the apocalypse of heaven on earth, or as Paul wrote, hope that is seen is not hope. Who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So, the first Sunday, we recognize the delay of the parousia, the failure of the primitive apocalyptic hope of the earliest church and its origins of Jewish apocalyptic. We saw how this material is often consolation literature developed among those outcast, downtrodden, forgotten, the least, the last, the lost. Apocalyptic gives voice to the hopes of the disinherited, and we hold and fiercely preach them here. We are not free, we said, to project our anxieties about the dilemmas of the current age, an age, by the way, that was supposed to have seen the end of history, out onto some far-off falsehood like the raptures of fancy fiction or facsimile, in order to avoid what we, of course, have to do in every other sphere of life. Take responsibility, negotiate, compromise, discuss, trade, and muddle through. Most especially, places like ours, Marsh Chapel, with a rich heritage of hope, must also expect of ourselves a rich offering to the future that comports with our inheritance. To whom much is given, from him much is expected. And we are not free to neglect a common hope. Here is our freedom. Pray daily for the hope of the world. Think creatively about the hope of the world. Act specifically week by week in communion with a reliable hope, because to some degree, the future is up to you. The second Sunday we saw in the very word revelation, which is rendered apocalypse, the inbreaking of God's love on earth, as Paul said when he received the gospel, Galatians 1, by apocalypse. Apocalyptic gives voice to the hope of faith in the face of all manner of death. You, Marsh Chapel, and every living, vibrant congregation are a beachhead in the invasion of God's new creation, heaven on earth. The third Sunday, we saw again how communal and common the ancient eschatological material was in its casting and framework. Apocalyptic gives voice to the voiceless, those left out by the reigning regime, including those left out of decent health care in our time, those unfortunate enough, that is, to live in a state other than Massachusetts. We heard, we said, yes, there will be bad news, there's no pretending otherwise, but do we really need to hurry it along? Why not be the harbingers of hope and allies of health and people who wish well for others? The fourth Sunday, we were treated to a careful interpretation of the beheading of John the Baptist, its apocalyptic foreground and background, its history and theology, and its comparisons to contemporary common family dysfunctions. The horizon of hope remains, the hope of blueberry pies cooked and enjoyed against a better series of familial arrangements than currently we experience. The fifth Sunday, we are taught again about the profound pessimism out of which apocalyptic grew, the despair at seeing anything finally righted or rightwised in this crooked world, and the shout of anger and courage faith kindles in such darkness. Hope has two beautiful daughters, said St. Augustine, anger and courage. Apocalyptic gives voice to the anger and courage present in those who despair, in those, including those injured by handguns in this country, and those willing to question the pervasive, dangerous presence of guns, 300 million in our land. The sixth Sunday, we were shown the emergence of Paul's apocalyptic gospel and the centrality of his apocalyptic hope for the rest of his work, especially that found in his magnum opus, the Epistle to the Romans. Apocalyptic gives voice in the face of death to the power of God's overcoming grace. Resurrection is resurrection from the dead. The seventh Sunday, we explored the horizons of endings and beginnings and how the apocalyptic worldview both aids and distorts our contemporary vistas. Apocalyptic gives voice to thinking about and working toward the betterment of environment, nuclear energy and weaponry, choices and decisions in the global community. The eighth Sunday, we were reminded of the crucial influence across the New Testament of apocalyptic, which one scholar called rightly the mother of Christian theology. It's not nice, we were reminded, to neglect mother, and so we determined. Apocalyptic gives voice to honesty about real evil in real time, from the Holocaust to Rwanda and everything in between. Mark's Jesus, we said, offers the beginning of his apocalyptic gospel. It is a song in the darkness. Yet amid the darkness, Mark's gospel speaks a promise of dawning light. The ninth Sunday, we listened for the gospel in the hour of Jesus' crucifixion, the dark hour in which the light of God's presence somehow continues to shine. Mark's gospel, we said, of an apocalyptic cross is therefore not just an orientation to a past, but a costly opening of the future, the new age that draws us in our lives forward, even in death's deepest shadows. Beloved, we have both the freedom and the responsibility at Marsh Chapel, now this 10th Sunday, to ring the bells of learning and piety, of mind and heart together, in a way that will inspire and guide another generation by the best insights of the faith we share. We have aimed high and stretched out these summer Sundays over 6 years. 1 year, we preached on new dimensions in ministry, another on leadership in the church, another on Darwin and faith, another on worship and preaching, another on church renewal, and this summer, Apocalypse Then. You will find these sermons published in our annual e-magazine, Motives, located on our website. While there are only a very few university pulpits remaining across this country, your support, your radio support, your generosity from near and far, the ongoing support of Boston University, and the hard labor of my staff and colleagues and guests here continue to allow us to treat hard topics with tough love. Apocalyptic is a song of hope, a hope of heaven on earth. It is a divine hope. It asks of us a certain height, a certain inclination, a change. It moves your soul, yourself, your center. It moves our being, Sunday by Sunday, closer to our ownmost self. It moves us out to a lastingly green pasture, a great snow-covered meadow of hope. In the year of my birth, 1954, Howard Thurman, then in his first year as Marsh Chapel Dean, gave lectures at what was to become my alma mater, Ohio Wesleyan. These latter were collected in a book, The Creative Encounter. With his minimal Christology, tangential connection to Paul, perennialist inclination against narrow religion, and distrust of large portions of the biblical tradition, Thurman would at first seem an unlikely interpreter of apocalyptic material. Yet his typically digressive, imaginative reflections, that 1954 Winter's Merrick Lectures at Ohio Wesleyan, at one point touched the very marrow of our theme this summer. Thurman is trying to explain religious experience. I wonder if you have had such. Its measure for him is not unlike the apocalyptic hope lifted this summer, said he. There is a point at which, for the individual, the surrender of the self in religious experience gives to life a purpose that extends beyond one's own private ends and personal risks. What happens when there is a new center for the focus of life? The answer is, in part, the following. At such a time as the new center becomes operative, the individual relaxes his hold upon himself as expressed in the self-regarding impulse. A different kind of value is placed upon his physical existence. The power of death over the individual life is broken, and the individual operates from a new center with all that is derived therefrom. The expression is the alteration of his private life growing out of a new value content. God has become the custodian of his conscience. God has become the custodian of his conscience. And this center of loyalty allows meaning for the personality, a shift from some primary social group loyalty to a loyalty to the command of God. I wonder, are you sensing the divine generosity inviting your one life to circle around a new center? Some prayer will guide you. Even a little bit of challenge and suffering may prod you. A moment in worship may lift you up. A friend, a word, a kindness, a note, a sunset, a kiss, a laugh. These are intimations of religious experience that are not at all religious, but they are real. Real they are. I wonder, is your center shifting? My dear beloved friends, community, congregation, and Marsh chapter, I believe in a way that I cannot understand in full or articulate in full that God's love outlasts death, that God's love is stronger than death, that God's love overcomes death. But it is not something that I see. It is something that I sense, though I cannot see it. But who hopes for what he sees? We hope for what we do not see, and we wait for it with patience. Amen.